This is Keeping the Faith on the Mormon Faircast. I'm your host, Bill Real. The Keeping the Faith series explores ways in which our faith can be challenged and ways in which we can overcome those challenges.
In today's episode, we interview John Montgomery, a faithful Latter-day Saint who encountered ridicule and persecution as a teenager and a young adult, causing him to spend time out of the church. He tells of his time exploring other faiths, his encounter with Hugh Nibley and Farms, the defending of his faith, and his return to the church with a greater appreciation for faith. John Montgomery, welcome.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Good, good. Glad to have you aboard. You and I have had some conversations back and forth, and I felt like it would be of worth to my listeners to give you a chance to share your story. And so I'm really excited about having this chance to sit down with you and to have this discussion, to talk about some things, and for you to share the experiences that you've had so that my listeners, especially a large group of them who either are in the midst of a faith crisis or who perhaps have even come out the other side in disbelief, might have an opportunity to see how other individuals handle their faith crisis and how they deal with different types of experiences in the church that sometimes cause these things to happen. So to kind of start us off, wondered if you might share with us some background about who you are so my listeners can get a feel for you.
I'm still trying to figure out who I am. But, you know, I'm a married guy with a great family. I live where I want to live. I love my life. I'm active in church. And, you know, I guess I'm kind of a Bill Real groupie,
awesome.
a fan. And I wanted to reach out to you and say thank you. And from that, you know, it kind of came up that maybe you thought my story had some value to people who maybe were going through similar things.
Excellent. So you and the other two groupies that I have all listen to the show, and I appreciate all three of you. So thank you. Tell me a little bit about your growing up.
Yeah, so my parents were both in the military when they met. My mom was a nurse, and my dad was a logistician. And they came from different backgrounds. My dad was from Kentucky. He is from Kentucky. And he joined the military as a way to get to college. And to support himself. And my mother joined because she wanted to learn nursing. She came from Idaho and a very large family and, you know, not privileged, circumstances. So, they met, they married. We stayed a military family and we moved around a lot. My dad was Lutheran, and I have, you know, memories of, as a young kid, you know, stealing sips from his beer stein and, you know, lots of pipes around and, you know, he would smoke out on the patio, and I still love the smell of pipes, you know, smoking
right.
pipes. And, my mom was probably the only active LDS person, in her family, but a family that, you know, raised in Pocatello, Idaho, the church was down the street. They were all probably members, but I think she was, you know, maybe the only one that stayed with the church.
Excellent. And so your mom was born in the church?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And, always stayed active and was a great influence on my dad and got him involved with the missionaries. And, you know, a classic story of a guy who goes through five or six sets of missionaries, lots of questions. But by the time I'm around 5 years old, we're living, my dad's stationed at the air base in Utah, and we're being sealed in the Ogden Temple. I still remember the powder blue ceiling room and my primary teacher's beehive hairdo. It was just a great experience. So I have, you know, siblings. At that time, you know, I had an older brother and a younger sister, and more kids joined the family in the covenant. But it was a good thing to be a member of the church. We were, you know, living in Utah and lots of friends around, and it was a great experience. But by the time I'm 7 or 8 years old, my dad gets an assignment to move to Southeast Asia. So we get on a plane, leave all of our friends, and for 3 years live on an island in southern Japan. And it's a pretty good environment to be a kid, to live in the military on a base. Very accepting, a lot of cultural, racial diversity. Everybody gets along really well, and it was a great place to be a kid. Terrific beaches. We had a jungle behind our house. There were all these crazy Japanese tombs in my backyard. All kinds of fun things for kids to explore and enjoy. And get into trouble with, and you know, occasional typhoon day where you don't have to go to school.
Awesome. A couple questions for you. First off, your dad was a logistician, someone who is in that field of mathematics. sometimes tends to have a very rigid approach to things. Was your dad kind of, when he came into the church, was he kind of like a fundamental kind of outlook on the church?
I don't know. I think it was more emotional for him. Yeah, I think it was. We've talked on rare occasions about his conversion. You know, we went through a long period where I just didn't want to talk about my faith with him, and I didn't ask him. And lately, in the last few years, we've taken a lot of trips together, just the two of us. We went to Northern Ireland and Italy to check out some leads on some genealogy. Have one Italian great-grandfather who came to the U.S. as he was Shanghai'd. He was hit on the head and was captured and brought to the U.S. to work as a pedal harpist on a steamer on the Mississippi. Yeah, that's my only Italian connection, but we're trying to find this guy's family.
Living in Southeast Asia for a while, was being in the military, did that shelter you from the Asian culture, or was it kind of unique being in the church in the midst of Southeast Asia?
Yeah, it was great. We went to a meeting house about 30 minutes away from the base, and my dad was, I think I said, the branch president of the servicemen's branch, but we shared that meeting house with at least one other ward or branch of Japanese members, and I loved it. I mean, we did everything we could to try and get out into Japanese culture. We lived off the base for a part of our time there and had lots of friends who were not American. You know, I would love to say that my Japanese extended beyond, you know, how much is this and what's this and insults that kids throw at each other, but I'm afraid I've lost most of it.
You said you joined the church that your family joined the church when you were quite young, but you had a couple of older brothers. Did they wrap their arms around the church as well?
Yeah, I have one older brother, and he ended up, you know, years later going back to Japan and served a mission in Sapporo. I would say that of my siblings, I'm probably the only one that had a real, you know, time outside the church.
Early childhood, church is very positive, families having great experiences in the church. So let's fast forward a little bit. What happens in high school?
Well, when we come back from Japan, we move to Ohio and things are fine there. Then my dad retires. You know, they want him to be a full colonel, and part of that compromise is that you leave your family for yet another 6 months. And he said, "Look, I've got six kids. I'm out." So he retired and went to work for a defense contractor, he was on the team that helped sell fighter jets. And we moved to Texas and had 1 year in junior high that was sort of, you know, typical miserable new kid. And then 4 years of high school in Texas, where I had a core group of friends, most of whom were not LDS. I think I was one of maybe 7 to 10 active LDS kids in my high school of probably 2,500 kids. I could be totally wrong on the numbers, but I think that's right.
Gotcha. So you've got a small group of Latter-day Saints, and you talk about being picked on a little bit. How did that affect you in the church or your membership?
Yeah, when you're when you have no natural, you know, reasons for kids to like you. I mean, you're not great at sports. You don't have, you know, a car. You know, and you're different. It wasn't ideal. I had, you know, good friends who were Baptists and Methodists, and I think even the few people that I stay in touch with from high school, very few people that I stay in touch with from high school, none of them LDS, and some really great people. So, but you know, you would have times when at random, it seemed like you'd be hit by a drive-by, you know, evangelical, you know, hit. And somebody would, you know, just come up to you and get in your face for whatever reason and say, you know, our minister was telling us about Mormons and you know you're going to hell, right?
Ouch. So here you are in high school. You're getting picked on by, from time to time, from the evangelicals.
Yeah, mostly. I mean, The time that sticks out for me, there, I guess there are two. You know, one is I'm in the lunchroom and a guy comes up to me and gets right in my face and just starts saying all these things about Mormons. And this is right when the God Makers movie has come out. And that was really uncomfortable because it was so, you know, it was such a public rebuke. And then the other time I had gone skiing, we went up to Durango, you know, Texans have no business skiing, but there we were. And I was with a Baptist church group. And, you know, some friends had invited me, and I thought, well, this would be great. Love to learn to ski.
Sure.
So we go on this trip, and one of the the main things that happened on this trip was it was a short trip. It was only a few days, but one of the nights everybody got together and it was supposed to be like a prayer meeting. But what I remember is me bringing my seminary Bible, with all my scripture markings in it, and spending probably 30 to 40 very uncomfortable minutes with a youth minister who sort of turned on me and had, I think really it's fair to say, sort of attacked my beliefs in front of a group of, 40 kids, and I'm 16, 17 at the time. And, I didn't need that. That was not great. I mean, I think I did okay for my team, but, it stuck with me that, why do I have to deal with all this? All these other kids, nobody's harassing them. The Baptists aren't really messing with the Methodists or the Presbyterians. Why am I part of a church that is so hated? Because it really was, this feeling of hatred. When you would tell people that you were Mormon, you got this response that was just totally out of proportion to anything I'd ever seen anywhere else.
Let me ask you a question. You had this experience on the ski trip. Did you feel like as soon as you walk in the room, they see you carrying this, quad set of scriptures that, to any Christian realizes that that's not a normal set of scriptures, and all of a sudden this minister starts to jump in and pick on you? Or do you feel like on some level they knew you were Mormon coming into this and kind of were preparing for you?
Everybody knew.
Gotcha.
I don't know how much preparation there was. I just know what happened. Who knows what they were thinking, but what happened was that the guy really had a prepared series of questions for me.
Right.
I remember pulling out the scripture in the, about where we talk about lost scriptures like, Nathan the prophet. And then I remember some discussion about faith versus works. This guy was ready. He had encountered Mormons before, or he had studied, the methods of attack.
Gotcha. So you come home from this ski trip, and over the next, weeks and months, how are things going with your testimony and your activity within the church?
I remember being active in seminary. I had that core group of friends who, scouts by this time is sort of over with, but I had a great scout troop. And then, I worked a lot. And the place where I worked, I think most of the staff was either active LDS or investigating. So we all sort of clung together. And so I had that core group of friends that I stayed with. And the testimony thing really wasn't what it should have been. I can't tell you that I read the Book of Mormon before college. I can't tell you that I, ever really tried to achieve a strong testimony. I just did what I needed to do to get through, get to college.
So what was college like?
My freshman year was a great time. I attended BYU as a freshman and had a lot of fun, met some great friends. In fact, one of those friends is instrumental in sort of my bigger picture conversion. And I got to see him yesterday, and we skied together for the first time in, probably 15 or 20 years. So it was a great time. I loved my religion classes, loved my generals, and, really no problems. Was happy to have spent that first year there.
What changed?
Well, I turned 19. It was time to not be a kid anymore. Time to decide what you really stand up for, what you really believe in.
Right. And being a member of the church, you've got a mission kind of hovering over you.
Had a mission hovering and needed to make a decision on that. Picked up a girlfriend in back home, and that was not helpful to my my church attendance or anything else. Went back to BYU for a third semester as a freshman and just thought, well, I'll figure this out. I wasn't sure I wanted to serve a mission. Didn't know how that would go over with either my parents, who really wanted me to serve but never really pressured me, and ended up changing schools and transferring back to Texas after that third semester because I just couldn't get to the point where I felt like I should go and that I believed in what I was being taught.
You're at college. You don't serve a mission. You choose not to go on a mission for the church. Anything else in college that's of notice?
Yeah, I remember having a couple of discussions with professors who were really vocal about their disbelief that I would associate with, the Mormons. And these guys were, I think, evangelicals also. And it was just so, blatant that they hated that belief system. And to please these guys, I mean, this was in my major field of study, and it was a very small group of professors. Let's say it was, 12 in that discipline. And, we all knew each other, and I was a teaching assistant for one of the professors, and one of them invited me to come to his church. So I went, and it was, what you would think. It was a very charismatic, large meeting. It was at night. It was almost like a gymnasium filled with, kids who were really into this and having a great time and praising God, and I loved that. And so I went back probably 2 weeks later. And this was more of a Sunday service. It was more, I guess we would say reverent, but sedate, where we listened to the preacher. And I would say it was probably not 5 minutes after I sat down that inexplicably the topic turned from whatever it was to how bad an influence the Mormon missionaries were in this college community, and all the problems that they were causing, and all falsehoods that they were spreading, and how we needed to pull the scales from their eyes.
Did that burn you a little bit? Or at this point, do you feel like, yeah, I'm a member of the church, I'm really not involved with the Mormon church anymore, and so it doesn't really bother me?
No, it hurt. I guess the takeaway for me was being a Mormon comes with a lot of baggage, and it's one of the more difficult things you can do. And if you're not sure that's what you want to do, you should look around. So I moved back to Texas. I ended up checking out lots of different churches. I remember going to Methodist churches, evangelical churches, because I really started to believe some of the things that I'd been, hit with. I started to question, is it really faith or is it really works? And is this choice that people have told me exists, and that I'm on the wrong side of, is that something that I need to learn more about? And I started to question whether Joseph Smith was really a prophet, whether the Book of Mormon was really true, because it seemed not to be, based on the information that was easiest for me to find. There were lots of bookstores where I grew up that had, Christian bookstores that had cult sections, and the attack the Mormon books are always in the cult section. And, it was so much easier to associate with some other faith or none at all that I really lapsed. I stopped attending church from the time I was probably 19 until I was about maybe 22 and a half, 23. And I remember when I did start to go back, it was sporadic. I went to a student ward occasionally in my college town. What a great bishop they had. What a nice group of people. But I never really attached to it. I just came in and left and, did a few things and, didn't do most things. So then I graduate from college. I start looking for jobs. And one of the first places I get an interview, and this was hard. I felt, sort of privileged to have gotten this interview, was with a sort of very difficult, I guess high status Fortune 500 company, that was based in Dallas. And so I go in for the interview, and they see BYU on my resume, and the interview turns from, wow, you've done really well in school, to tell us about that you're a Mormon. And I freeze in this important interview. I just freeze. And they say to me, no, listen, we like Mormons. And I just look around the room, and I think, okay, I don't want to make a big deal about this, but why are you guys asking me these questions? I'm not sure that this is cool with the EEOC.
Right. They're breaking lots of rules.
Yeah, and I thought, if this is the kind of organization, I think I don't really want to be here. And I sort of, just checked out for the rest of the interview and left, and started looking elsewhere. And I looked at a bank that specialized in the kind of work I wanted to do. They had a very high concentration in that asset class. And I went in for the interviews. Three positions were open, and I was down to the last set of interviews. And I went in to meet with one of the executives, one of the guys who would make the decision. And he looks at my resume, and I'll never forget this. He's leaning back in sort of an easy chair behind a huge desk. I've got downtown Dallas in the background out of his window on the 20th floor. And he looks over his reading glasses at me, and he just sort of sniffs, and he says, you're not Mormon, are you? And I just thought, what do I have to do? I mean, how do I escape this? And I just said to him, you know, I was raised Mormon. I don't really do much with it. And that was my out. That's what I did, Bill. I've got to think about that for the rest of my life. You know, that's the place I was. Where do I wish I had been? Someplace completely different. But that's what I have to think about.
Did you get hired?
Yeah. Yeah, but did I get hired at the expense of, you know, my my upbringing?
And I realize, you know, you're saying that, and I understand where you're coming from, having gone through everything and being in a place now where you come from a completely faithful perspective and looking back at times when you don't stand up for the church. But at the same time, too, I mean, certainly you look back on those times and realize that you were struggling and maybe not making heads of tails of what you knew and what you didn't know anyway. I'm not trying to excuse it. I'm just, you know, a young person straight out of college trying to find a job and really maybe never having had a testimony up to that point.
Right.
Struggling with all the baggage that sometimes comes along with being a Latter-day Saint, especially in communities where you've got evangelicals and other folks who look down upon Latter-day Saints and realizing all the stuff you're up against. I mean, that has to kind of weigh in on that whole situation as well.
Right, right.
Along this way, John, you're to the point here where you've accepted a job at the expense of having to essentially not stand up for the church. Are you in your testimony, are you completely away from having a testimony of the church, or are you just simply not interested? You know, let me put it this way. In the church, people fall away for lots of different reasons. Some people fall away simply because it just doesn't capture their interest. It isn't appealing to them. And for others, they see it as something they need to get as far away from as possible. Where are you kind of on that spectrum?
I'm focused on different things. I'm focused on trying to have a career. I love, you know, outdoor sports, things like that. So I'm thinking about other things that maybe kids in their young 20s who, you know, get out of college and finally have a little cash start thinking about. I spend, though, my vacation time visiting two guys that I knew from freshman year at BYU. And these are two very solid. I would say that in our dorm, these were the two guys that we all looked up to the most, who had their testimonies sorted, who had their study habits just down. These are great guys, great examples. And I stayed in touch with them. And, you know, this is all pre-internet. So it's writing letters or calling on the phone every once in a while. And I really admired these guys, both from Minnesota, and they would, you know, invite me, hey, come, you know, stay with us. You can sleep on our couch. Let's go skiing. And I did. And while I was there, the topic turned to belief and how their missions had gone. And gosh, I missed that whole thing. I had a lot of questions. And some of these attacks that I'd sort of been through and still thought about and took very personally and was hurt by, I wanted to know more. I wanted to know, why do you guys believe this when there's all this out there? And so one of the greatest things that happened to me, they said to me, look, go and talk to this religion professor that I know. This guy's name is Reed Benson. And Reed Benson turns out to be Ezra Taft Benson's son, I'm told. So I go to see Reed Benson, and he just, you know, he lets me in his office, and he takes some time to talk to me, but he really refers me to this other place down the hill, in this sort of second-rate building on campus called Farms. And so I go into Farms, and I find this guy, and I wish I could remember his name. A terrific guy. I know I've got it somewhere. But he's the director of Farms. And he listens to my story. And he says, you know, I think we can get you there. And he loads me up. He gets a box, a big cardboard box, and he throws all these Farms updates and all these videos and all these audio cassettes, a few Nibley, and he fills this thing to capacity. Now I've got, you know, 50, 60, 70 pounds worth of books and materials to get back to Texas on an airplane. But I'm actually thrilled about this, and I devour it, okay? And about the same time at my work, there's become this Bible study group. This Bible study group has formed. And there's a guy on my floor who I would say is a superior of mine who leads this Bible study. And I care about my testimony of Jesus Christ, and I want to better understand the Bible. And I attend this class as sort of a non-denominational believer who hopes that he's got everything sorted with Christ. And they let me talk one time, and I turn the discussion to faith versus works. And one of the books that I've been given by Farms is this fabulous book called Understanding Paul by Richard Lloyd Anderson. And I start walking through the ladder of faith that's found in several places in the New Testament. And that doesn't go over well. And I'm sort of disinvited to the Bible study. And this guy gets to the point where he's stopping me every time I see him in the hallway at work, the superior who leads the Bible study. And he's saying things to me like, hey, do you know that Joseph Smith just made up that word, telestial? Do you know? And he's just, it's on his mind constantly. And he comes by my office one day, right before the weekly staff meeting, probably 5 minutes before, and he sits down and he starts going over probably 20 or 30 different things that he just can't believe anybody could ever believe about Mormons. And didn't you know this? And haven't you heard this? And how can you believe that? How could you possibly believe that? And I'm taking the position of, I'm not really a believer. I'm listening to what you're saying. And I was raised in this, you know, faith, but you're sort of attacking my parents and my family's beliefs. And I want to do something to defend that. So we take up a correspondence. And I should say on that day, his boss had to come tell him to get out of my office because I was, you know, there's going to be a harassment claim.
Right.
But so we take up a quiet correspondence. And as I said, this is pre-internet. So I start answering his one-line questions by doing my own research. And I find a Deseret book and I start working out these long answers with some of the Nibley that I found, some of the Farms Insights and other little books like Thunders for a Word, and, you know, The Truth About the God Makers. And I start to try and, you know, make this okay in my own mind while still, you know, answering his questions. But it was this, you know, typical hit and run evangelical situation where he says one thing, you respond with vigor, and then we're on to the next topic. You know, he drops that and moves on to the next line of attack. And about this time, I get a call from a guy sort of out of the blue, I think, but you know, clearly my parents have tipped off the local singles ward that I live in Dallas, and they should seek me out. And this guy, who I can't remember his name either, but he calls me up and he says, hey, man, I'm your home teacher. Do you want to start coming to the ward? And I say, yeah, probably. And he says, well, great. Where do you live? Oh, geez, I'm probably 40 minutes from where that meeting house is. And he says, well, I'll come get you. And this guy comes to get me and drives me to church for probably, I don't know, maybe a 6 month period.
Awesome.
And I start thinking about my testimony and I think about, you know, what it means, and the fact that I sort of gave up on something in my life, which was the church and BYU. So I apply for graduate school and I apply two or three places and I did well enough that I started getting all these catalogs in the mail from expensive schools back east. And I say, no, I'm going to apply to BYU. And I do, and I'm accepted. And Bill, you know, somewhere along the way, I must have had a meeting with the bishop that counted as an ecclesiastical endorsement meeting.
Right.
But I can't tell you that I you know, passed or should have passed, but the bishop had enough sense to say, let's get this guy to BYU, and it'll all work itself out on the next bishop. But yeah, I should say, too, that that bishop, I said to him, do you think I should go to graduate school or do you think I should serve a mission? I'm, you know, 22, 23 at this point. No, I'm probably older than that. I'm probably 24. And he said, no, I feel that you shouldn't serve a mission, that you should just go to graduate school. And I felt a little disappointed about that because I sort of felt as though I let the church down or, you know, didn't fulfill my duty and probably missed out on a beautiful experience that my skiing buddies had told me about. So, you know, by the things I'm telling you, it's becoming clearer to me now as we discuss it that I cared more about the church than maybe I think I did at the time.
So, John, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but it seems apparent to me, you're having this correspondence back and forth with the manager at the bank, and he's throwing, you know, one-line questions to you. You're sending him back these answers in which you're exploring the faith, you're doing research, you're getting books, you're reading on it. Is it at this point where you start to realize that within the faith of Mormonism, there are lots of things that actually come off as more reasonable, making more sense than the answers that other Christian denominations have for some of these questions?
Well, I would say that there were defensible positions, right? I think about that Augustine Ferrer quote that I'll quote it for you. It says, though argument does not create conviction, lack of it destroys belief. You know, what seems to be proved may not be embraced, but when no one shows the ability to defend is quickly abandoned. Rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish. And that's how I started to feel. Oh, I've got a reason, a rationale for accepting this. And I'll tell you, my heart started to be in it.
Right, right. Things start to make sense. People are asking, you know, this guy's asking questions, and as you're looking up answers, you're going, hey, there are good, solid answers here, and it gives you kind of a foundation to start building on. Do you feel like you, in this discussion back and forth with the bank manager, begin to develop what I would call, or what you would call, a testimony?
Yeah, I had a little tiny seed of faith. And Bill, one of the most enjoyable moments in my discussions with that guy was when I walked in and he said to me, hey, I heard you're going to go to graduate school and get an MBA. And I said, yeah, I'm going to BYU. And the look on his face was, what have I done? You know.
Well, I was going to ask if his jaw dropped. And perhaps maybe even he recognized at this point that him pushing you a little bit probably helped in this whole process of you developing your faith.
I think he just thought I was lost and I could never be recovered, and he had done all he could for me. He's a nice man. I wish him the best. He's not a bad person. We were on different sides.
Sure.
You know, he was fighting for my soul. You know, I appreciate his effort.
And I certainly know where you're coming from too, in the respects of whenever we get in these type of dialogues with other faiths, and especially evangelicals, that the approach tends to be, and like you say, they're working to try and help you, to rescue you, to save you. But it is frustrating when they throw something out at you, you feel like you're in the midst of giving a good answer, and all of a sudden question number two comes in before the person's even conceded that you've given a decent answer on question number one.
Happens a lot.
You complete the BYU application, you're going to BYU to further your education. How was graduate school?
I loved it, all right? So, and one of the main reasons I loved it was that I had a terrific bishop. I had a mentor in my bishop, a guy that... intellectually, I just felt such a strong connection to, and spiritually, he was a terrific coach. And his wife and his family really almost adopted me. You know, they thought, where did this guy come from, maybe? But we've stayed very close, and I consider him almost as a second father. So as my bishop, in my first interview, you know, I think he had me, he had some assignments for me, and, you know, he would say things like, well, read Section 88 this week, or read The Miracle of Forgiveness. And I'd come back the next day and say, okay, I read it, and here's what I learned, and these are my questions. And you know, I was really passionately interested in everything about the church by this point, and I was really motivated to get on track and really to settle down into a strong testimony and find a wife, I guess. I mean, to find peace and happiness and all the joy that my friends who had stayed in the church and never taken a hiatus were now enjoying.
So do you feel like you're moving upward at this point, right? I mean, you feel like you're progressing, you're kind of gaining more information, knowledge about the church, your faith is growing, the seed of testimony is sprouting. You've got this gentleman who's, in a sense, kind of adopted you into his family.
Yeah, he's a great influence on me, a good example. He has answers, and he's thoughtful. And I'm surrounded by great people in my business school program and lots of other good people in my ward and my neighborhood. So it's an environment where I'm flourishing and do well in school. This bishop of mine, this great friend, I asked to ordain me to the Melchizedek priesthood. And then he, says, let's get ready to take you, through the temple. And I, that's the one sort of unknown for me. You know, I don't really know what happens in the temple. So I take the temple prep class, and I'm kind of still shy about discussing everything with my parents. I think because of my past disassociation with the church, I don't really want to open up to my parents for some reason. And so I call my folks and I say, I'm going through the temple. I probably let them know that I'd been ordained, and you know, maybe my dad said, "Gosh, I wish you would have let me know, so I could have come out and done that."
Right.
But he comes to my endowment, and so I've got my bishop on one side, my dad on the other, and it's just great. And I have lots of questions right after the temple session, but I'm in. I'm really engaged in becoming a better member, a better follower of Christ, and getting a stronger testimony. And I remember getting on a program where I'm going to the temple, you know, two, possibly three times a week and just loving it. And, you know, I end up meeting a beautiful member of the church and in a very short period of time, asking her to marry me. And we get married, shortly after I graduate and start working for another company, in Salt Lake.
You get ordained, you go to the temple, your mom and dad now are completely aware of the progress that you've made. I'm sure that they're happy and ecstatic about all of that. Kind of made amends with the divide between you and the church, and things are going super well. You're obviously super active. You're loving it. You're reading everything you can get your hands on. Where do you go from there?
Well, I've never been inactive since, and I have a wonderful wife, and she's somebody who's always believed, but not always believed in sort of a cheap faith kind of way. She's had experiences that have brought her to a real, deep, tender, and I'll say, you know, fairly early appreciation of God's love. And so she's been a good influence on me. Lots of different callings, you know, everything from scoutmaster to working in the youth to being executive secretary to being elders quorum president. And probably about, you know, maybe let's call it 5, maybe 8 years ago, I sort of realized that I'm stuck, that I haven't progressed the way I had, that the sprinting of my early, you know, reconciliation with the church has sort of mellowed into a light jog. And it's not that I've made mistakes or done things to push myself away from the church, but that energy, that drive, just isn't maybe sustainable. Or maybe it's that I'm not able to commit because of things that are going on with work and family the way I used to. And so I feel like I get stuck on a plateau, and that plateau stays there. You know, I stay stuck on that for probably, as I said, you know, 8, maybe even 10 years. And I should say, Bill, that during this time, I've still got a lot of lingering questions about certain aspects of the gospel. I am not somebody who can just believe something easily. I wish I were gifted that way, but that's not my gift. I'm more a believe on the testimony of others person. That's maybe how it works for me.
Right.
Although in college I did have, and this was graduate school, I did have an experience that was so overwhelmingly comforting and beautiful. I don't want to talk about it too much, but I felt God answer a prayer in a way that I know was not self-generated. This feeling of absolute peace that washed over me was outside my own experience or my own, you know, making. And that stuck with me. And I sort of looked back on that and thought, well, if I sung the song of redeeming love once, I can feel that again. But I wanted that more frequently, and it didn't come. You know, everybody's got their pet questions. I had no problem. Nibley got me so comfortable and loving the Book of Abraham, The Pearl of Great Price. But I could never really get there on the Book of Mormon. And the historicity of it really still is sort of a challenge for me. I can't say that I understand it all or, you know, think it fits perfectly, but that's just up there on the shelf for me. I've come a long way. There's been a lot of great material recently. And of course, you know, I read all the Sorensen. I'm pretty excited for his new
Mormon Codex.
New Codex that's coming out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've traveled a lot in Latin America as well. And, you know, I remember being in Copan one day with my guide, and it was just me. And I'm there with this guide, this wonderful guide. And we come around a corner to one of the main temple complexes, and there's this group, and they're all sitting on the, you know, sort of the ancient pyramid steps. And there's a guy leading this tour group, and he's leading an LDS tour group here in the middle of Honduras. And I sort of can't believe my eyes and ears. And, I sort of eavesdrop for a little while. And then I go back, you know, on the rest of my walk with my guide, and he's shaking his head. And I say, "What's the matter?" And he says, "Ah, it just bugs me so much that these guys come here and say all these things happened here, and it doesn't fit the timeline. And I just can't believe any of that, you know." So, you know, there are things about it that make me pause as a believer, but I have come a long way since that day. So.
Gotcha. You know, you talk about some of these tour groups that give, you know, you pay money, you go down to Central America, and these folks go around from pyramid to pyramid telling you that this probably happened here and that probably happened there. And while I think for those whose knowledge or understanding of these types of issues probably is boosted from that type of stuff, for those who delve deeply into the Book of Mormon historicity and study up on these kinds of issues with Sorensen's map and those kinds of things, I wonder sometimes if these groups really do some harm as well in trying to say, you know, we know for sure it's right here, and this temple here that was used by the Incans is probably, you know, where King Benjamin gave his address or whatever those situations are.
Yeah, you mentioned the Inca, and it happens in Peru as well. But in Central America, most of the Mayan sites, you know, I think have some somebody who's written about them who says, hey, this is where this likely happened. You know, I think some of those tour leaders are really sincere, but I think some of them are maybe exaggerating things to the benefit of their future bookings.
Sure.
And I just hope that the people who go and have those experiences, you know, leave and do their own homework.
Right.
And it's not to say that, you know, the Book of Mormon lands can't be overlapped with the Mayan lands, but we've got a lot more work to do.
Yeah, and we need to tread softly when we're going to tell people that things likely happened at this exact location. Even if the Book of Mormon takes place in that specific area, to start naming sites and starting to speak about where things actually occurred is probably stepping a little too far into the unknown.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, if I can go back 1 second.
Sure.
I want to tell you one of the greatest things that happened. I mean, when I was in college, when I was in graduate school at BYU, I took some time to go back and say thank you to the farms people and kind of let them know where I'd ended up and how it had all worked out and how it had helped me. And I think the guy who really helped me the most, I want to say his name was Brent Hall. So Brent Hall, if you're out there, thank you. You know, he was happy to see me, and I was happy to see that farms had sort of grown up since, you know, the few years earlier, that they really helped me. But I took some time one day after devouring, you know, thousands of pages of Nibley, to walk up to his office, which was on, I don't know, the third or fourth level of the library there on campus, the Lee Library. And I took my books in there to see him. And I remember I was wearing a plaid shirt, and I saw this, that's him. He's in the next room. And I talked to his secretary for a second. I said, look, it would be an honor to meet Dr. Nibley. Could I maybe have him sign my books? And at this point, I don't know, he's 103.
Right.
So, you know, I'm pretty excited to have this meeting, you know, quickly, because this guy's, you know, how long is he going to last? So I get to go in there and I say, you know, Dr. Nibley, I'm a big fan. And, you know, I read these books, and all he cares about is that I'm wearing a plaid shirt and that my name is Montgomery. And he wants to talk about Scotland. And he ends up signing all my books and doing each one in kind of a funny, different way. You know, some of them have jokes. Some of them just compliment my Scottish heritage, things like that. So those were two other highlights of graduate school. And I took classes while I was, you know, studying business. I also would take religion classes. Great class on Dead Sea Scrolls by Dana Pike and some other classes. I went back to Richard Lloyd Anderson and took his class on the witnesses. And all of these things just really helped shape my testimony, that little seed of a testimony that I had.
The stuff that Farms had given you early on and the things that Nibley had signed for, you still have all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Those are treasures.
Awesome. You probably pull those out every once in a while and just go through them?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet some of my other favorite authors since then. The bishop that I mentioned, who was such a good mentor to me, is good friends with Jack Welch. So I've been able to meet and talk to him a couple of times and ask him a few questions. But I love his work on, you know, Sermon at the Temple, Sermon on the Mount, and really enjoy everything that Sorensen's given us on Book of Mormon lands. And the guy that's really carried me lately, and maybe I can use this as a transition, about maybe, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, Tyrell Givens gave a terrific devotional address at BYU called Lightning Out of Heaven. And I have listened to that talk, I don't know, 30, 40 times now. And to me, it is the most, it's just so meaningful. Enough so that I actually contacted him and thanked him for his thoughts. And since then, I've been reading more of what he's done. I just finished, you know, By the Hand of Mormon, and bought my wife the God Who Weeps for Christmas, which you know, it was a surprise to me to see that that was a Deseret book, but there's a good interview that he's done recently with Sherry Dew that talks about how that happened.
So you talk about how you were at this plateau for a while, and you wanted to kind of have the progress be as fast as it was, as exciting as it was earlier on when you came back into activity. You talk about kind of progressing from reading about Nibley or Welch to Bushman and Givens. Where are you at today, and how did you get there?
Today, I would say that I've finally made it off the plateau. I am a gospel doctrine teacher. I teach a class of maybe, I don't know, 40 or 50 adults every week, and I really throw my heart into it. And I've been doing that since, let's see, we're in Doctrine and Covenants now this year, and I started in the last half of the Old Testament. And it's really helped me, especially last year with the Book of Mormon, appreciate it in a new way, and stop worrying so much about some of my questions and thinking more about the doctrine and what's really being said there. I'm never going to dismiss my questions, but I put them up on a shelf while I, you know, work on other things. And I think about a talk that Daniel Peterson gave. I think it was called An Apology for Apologetics, where he talks about, you know, the testimony that anybody can give is that this is good. And that's a testimony that I was really comfortable giving. And if you're in my ward or you know me, you know, I'm not one of these people who stands up and says, I know this and I know that. I hope, I believe, I pray. And, you know, through that process and that study, I've really started to see the fruits of it all. And some of the questions that I've had, I've been able to find terrific, you know, logic-based answers to. And some of the other ones, I've just had so much peace that they don't seem important to me anymore. It's almost as though you say to yourself, oh, thank you for that affirmation. I withdraw the question.
Right, right.
And I feel stupid asking now. And so, yeah, you know, I have my set of pet questions. You know, if somebody out there can help me, walk me through how Joseph Smith is a literal descendant of Joseph of Egypt, I'd love to know about that. But, you know, that's just this month. I think the takeaway for me is that I have felt charity. I have felt the love of Christ. I have felt grace filling me up and giving me the love and the strength that I need to, you know, raise my kids and get through, you know, difficult situations, maybe at work where, you know, you could work into an argument, but instead you work out a good, well, Christian solution. And I used to think that it was, that by study and also by faith, the study part was all the apologetics and all of the, you know, historical arguments and the all that stuff, all the logic, and that the by faith was the doctrine. And now I am convinced that you need to be studying the doctrine and that you may need to apply faith to the logic or the historicity.
You know, a lot of people look down on putting things on a shelf, and they use that as a way to say, you know, you're just pushing away the inevitable. And yet, like you, I think when we are able to say, look, I can't know everything, not everything's going to make sense, like you're pointing out here, the difference in what your progression was in understanding faith, that faith isn't this knowledge based in spiritual things, it's this choice you make that not having all the answers, you're still able to move forward and act.
Yeah, that's the Givens. You're on this, you know, and let's bring Nibley in too. You're on a continuum. You're on a line. And Babylon's that direction and Zion's that direction. And, you know, it's about choice. It's about which direction do you turn? Where are you facing? That's more important maybe than even position.
So we talk about people who look down on us as Latter-day Saints who don't have all the answers, putting things on a shelf. But like you, I've come to the realization that if you're able to do that and really understand what faith is and to go ahead and move forward anyway, one thing that I am, at least in my own life, certain of, is that President Kimball was absolutely right when he said faith precedes the miracle. And what I mean by that is the more we act in faith, the more spiritual assurance, and it may not come in a day, and it may not come in 2 weeks, it may be months, it may be years, but the more spiritual assurance that comes along to say, hey, you know what, you're going in the right direction.
That's it. You have to step into the dark. And like Given says, if you've turned towards Christ and you recognize him as the most worthy being to emulate, then that speaks of the best in you and can help you progress. There was a talk by a, I think you would call him an amateur historian, who he did a presentation recently in the last few years on, you know, what he had learned about polygamy in the early church. And he was encountering things that troubled him. And he said, and I can't put this out here the way that he did so beautifully, but he said, if you can I said to God, I'm going to study this, but I promise you that I will be faithful to you no matter what comes from this. You have my commitment. And he said he consecrated his brain. And from that commitment, everything else either was answered, or he had other assurances for, and his testimony flourished from the whole process. In fact, you know, it was more like he was given answers. What he got from it was assurance and knowledge that was so much better than he ever could have achieved if he had just sat down with his books.
I've had interviews with Brian Whitney. I've listened to podcasts of other members of the church who are in the academic field and work with things of scholarship. And almost to a T, those who are willing to act in faith and then delve into the original source material to try to answer some of these tough questions, almost to a T, seem to grow in faith and testimony as they do so. And I find that, you know, for those of the individuals of the church who struggle and who are in a faith crisis, who are trying to find their way through it, it just, and I know it doesn't seem like it should be that way. Like, hey, I'm going to delve into the original source material and I'm going to uncover even more problems and I'm going to go further into losing my testimony. But I think listeners need to realize that it's actually the opposite that happens, that the more people act in faith and move forward, but still are in the midst of dealing with tough stuff, that for many of them, if not a whole, you know, large segment of them, answers come. Things begin to build line upon line, principle upon principle, and people begin to have these testimonies that grow even in the midst of what you would think is dealing with tough issues.
Yeah, I think I can bear testimony of that myself. I don't know why we're so surprised. Isn't this what we're told will happen?
Right.
You know, you have faith, you act in faith, and you'll receive an increase afterward.
Yeah. I love Alma 32, where Alma's talking about building faith like a seed, and he says, is your faith perfect? And he says, nay, it is only perfect in that thing. And I love that, because sometimes we feel like, you know, we get an answer on one subject, and that just means the entire gospel is perfect in our minds. But no, it's building things just a little at a time. Maybe your testimony is perfect in tithing, and so now you move on to the word of wisdom, or maybe now you move on to understanding the mercy of God, or better understanding the other blessings of the atonement. It just seems like in the gospel, if we just tackle the little things that are in front of us, as you were kind of hinting at earlier, we'll move forward. And if we recognize that faith is not knowing things perfectly, in fact, what does Paul say in Hebrews 11, that faith is to hope for things the evidence of which not seen? And to me, that's just gorgeous. I mean, and we don't point it out that right way, right? We teach Moroni chapter 10, 3 through 5, and we bang that scripture in everybody's heads. And yet, there's so many scriptures that testify of a completely different way of gaining a testimony.
There are different avenues. There are different gifts. God's got a way for each of us to get there.
Right.
And if I can bear testimony of Jesus Christ and the atonement and that the church is good, that's valuable. You know, maybe I can't give you a testimony that, you know, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec is the right spot, or,
right.
you know, that, whatever. But I've got value.
Yeah.
My testimony is meaningful, and it brings me joy, real joy, to be able to teach the gospel and to, yeah, feel the peace that I now feel.
Right. I was thinking about that today in testimony meeting, and like you, my testimony is worded different than I probably would have worded it 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And like you, I deal much more with the things that there's some things I know, some things I hope, some things I believe in, and I choose my words carefully. But I was sitting up on the stand today and thinking about my testimony, and like you, I thought to myself, you know, yes, there's things I don't have answers to, but I absolutely have a testimony that being in the church, serving in the church, being a member of it, is just, it's brought tenfold blessings into my life that I know I wouldn't have had if I'd have been in any other walk of life.
Amen.
You talked about earlier, I think it was out of Doctrine and Covenants section 46, thinking maybe it's verses 13 and 14, which says it's given unto some to have the gift of, and I'm gonna chop it up, but given the gift of faith to know that Jesus is the Christ, and it is given unto others to believe on their words that they may have eternal life also. And I love how you said earlier that, you know, at times you've been in a place where your makeup is such that your gift is to just believe on the words of others and not necessarily have those spiritual experiences yourself. And what a strength it is to have a gift to be able to lean on the words of others and to move forward not having your own answer.
You know, we're in a church. We're in a family. We're not individuals in this process. We're not on this journey alone. And we can help each other. I can carry you through if you have questions about, you know, what Jesus did and didn't do. Or if you have questions about the Pearl of Great Price, you need to carry me a little on, you know, maybe some Book of Mormon things. We're all here to help each other as a ward family and as a church. And that's beautiful.
Right.
And it works.
You talked about Terrell Givens, by the way. You could probably know, but he's a hero of mine as well. And he's helped me restructure what I have to believe in to be a member of the church and what I have flexibility in to not believe in and essentially set off to the side as the opinion of somebody or not official doctrine. And I came to a realization that the bucket of things that we have to believe in is so much smaller than the average member realizes. And you talked about how his talk, Lightning Out of Heaven, was kind of a defining moment for you, or one of these things you've looked back on with kind of a marker in your spiritual growth is helping you progress. And maybe just to share a little story, I had a moment about 5 years ago. I'm called to be a bishop. I'm talking to the youth of my ward. Some of them are struggling. I'm talking to members of my ward. Some of them are struggling. And I'm telling them to just hang in there and to keep trying, that God values the effort. And yet, in my own testimony at the time, I was this work, 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 hammer it out, perfect yourself, you know, set the bar high and you bust your butt and you get there. And all of a sudden, in my own personal life, a few things happened where I just hit rock bottom and realized that I was not going to, wasn't going to perfect myself on my own. And I became quite discouraged. And like you turning to Givens in the Lightning Out of Heaven talk, a talk I came across was Brad Wilcox's His Grace is Sufficient. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
Yeah, I have. It's great. It's great.
And for me, it changed the whole dynamic on what grace means within the LDS Church and what I have to do on my part to then combine with Christ's merits, mercy, and grace from the atonement and get me back to the celestial kingdom, to get me back to heaven, to get me back into the presence of my Heavenly Father. And maybe, you know, one thing the two of us maybe can share is that if anybody out there is feeling discouraged or struggling or having a hard time reconciling the ways in which you see the historical aspects of the church and how things fit in a historical context, and I've listened to that talk as well, Lightning Out of Heaven, perhaps listeners could take those two talks and listen to them, and I think they both offer so much for every member of the church to have some growth.
Yeah, and one of the things that Fiona and Terrell Givens talk about a lot in this new book is that, you know, it's okay to say that you believe, that you have faith. We've had this unfortunate cultural shift to using the language of knowing.
Yeah.
And it's not gospel. It's not necessary that you know. You can have faith. You can believe. That is actually encouraged.
Right.
It's, you know, that's a natural
yeah.
step.
Faith is not knowledge. It's to act in the absence of knowledge. It's to move forward anyway.
I would rather have faith any day than knowledge.
Right, and you're right. We've set up a culture that sets knowledge up as the desirable trait, and yet knowledge is nowhere to be found in the principles and ordinances of the gospel.
Yeah, well, Jesus said, you know, blessed are those who believe. You know, not necessarily those who had it right. shown to them. Right. I mean.
Right. You got it, Thomas. Are there any other things you feel like you want to cover?
Yeah, I want to say something that you can't cut out, which is, Bill, you know, thank you for all that you do on the podcast. It really is a pleasure to listen to what you put out there. I know this has got to take time away from your family, and I know you've put a lot of thought and time into it, and you've really meant a lot to me, and I've shared your work with other people, and I hope you continue to do this and know that it has real value.
I appreciate that greatly.
Don't be modest.
No,
it's
true. And I do. I mean, I appreciate it greatly. It's become a love of mine only because the more I'm doing this, the more I realize how many people out there need things like this, a place to go where things are talked about in a different way and more out in the open, because there's people out there who are struggling and hurting and having a hard time, and perhaps their support group or the people around them aren't as open or understanding of some of these issues and don't know how to approach them. And I just hope that this podcast is a place for people to not only get answers, that's kind of secondary, but a place to feel validated and to feel like, hey, I'm not alone out there.
Yeah, you're not alone. And, you know, Bill, it's great to talk with you and to hear what you have to say, because you know, you're a bishop, you're active in the church, your testimony is strong, and you still understand the struggles that people have had because you've had a faith crisis, and you're one of those who recognizes the value of these people who care so much that they really want to know, and who knowledge maybe doesn't come easily for, but who put the time and the effort into trying to gain a better testimony, and sometimes it's slow in coming.
Right. Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Mormon Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Mormon Apologist by visiting the Fair Mormon contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help us increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Chris Rice. The opinions expressed in the podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of Fair Mormon.
Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love. Here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God. He to rescue me from danger interposed his precious blood. Precious blood. Oh, that day when freed from sinning, I shall see thy lovely face. Clothed then in blood-washed linen, how I'll sing thy sovereign grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry, take my ransomed soul away. Send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I am constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it, seal it for thy courts above. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it for thy courts above.